"You said at the end of last term you were going to tell me everything," said Harry. It was hard to keep a note of accusation from his voice. "Sir," he added.
"And so I did," said Dumbledore placidly. "I told you everything I know. From this point forth, we shall be leaving the firm foundation of fact and journeying together through the murky marshes of memory into thickets of wildest guesswork. From here on in, Harry, I may be as woefully wrong as Humphrey Belcher, who believed the time was ripe for a cheese cauldron."
Welcome to the Basic Cinephile Podcast, Season 1, Harry Potter. Hello, everyone. I'm your host, Ziana.
And I'm your other host, Adelia. This season on the Basic Cinephile Podcast, we are reading all the Harry Potter books and watching all the Harry Potter movies. And this week, we are kicking off episode 12 with the sixth book, Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince.
This podcast contains spoilers. This book has been out for 17 years, so we don't feel bad spoiling anything and everything about it. But if at this exact moment you have decided to dive into the magical world, pause the episode and go read all the books and binge all the movies, because honestly, who knows how many books and movies we will end up referencing in this episode.
So at this point, there is no denying that Lord Voldemort has returned after the battle at the Ministry. Sirius is dead, Lucius Malfoy is in Azkaban, and Rufus Scrimgeour has taken over as the new Minister of Magic. Everyone suspects that Harry is the Chosen One, and with that, people want a piece of him more than ever.
When Dumbledore comes to collect Harry for the summer holidays, the two make a detour to the temporary safe house of Horace Slughorn, a former professor at Hogwarts. Taking full advantage of Harry's fame and notoriety, the pair are able to convince him to return to his post. However, it is a surprise to everyone at the start of term feast to hear that Slughorn is resuming his post as the potions professor, meaning one thing: Snape will finally be teaching Defense Against the Dark Arts as he has always desired.
In addition to private lessons with Dumbledore, Harry now has the required OWLs to continue with potions. Not having any of the required materials, he is given school supplies and a textbook that has been extremely marked up, with tips and tricks to make the potions by the previous owner, who calls himself the Half-Blood Prince. Having taught his mother, Lily, Professor Slughorn attributes Harry's newfound potion-making abilities to natural skill, but not everyone is convinced of this.
Harry is more paranoid than ever this year. He blames Snape for the death of Sirius, and to the annoyance of his friends, is convinced that Malfoy is a Death Eater who is up to something sinister. When Katie Bell is severely injured from a cursed necklace, and Ron is poisoned by a bottle of mead that was meant to be a Christmas present for Dumbledore, Harry is more sure than ever that Malfoy is behind it all.
During his private lessons with Dumbledore, the time is spent deep diving into Tom Riddle's past through various memories that Dumbledore has collected. The most important of all these memories comes from Professor Slughorn, and it contains an interaction that he had with Tom Riddle, where he explained how Horcruxes can be used to store part of a person's soul and help a person get closer to immortality.
Armed with this new information, Dumbledore and Harry set out to find and destroy one of Voldemort's Horcruxes. When they return with the Horcrux, Dumbledore is badly injured and they need to find Snape ASAP. But to their horror, the Dark Mark has been set over Hogwarts and Death Eaters have been smuggled into the castle.
Dumbledore is cornered by Draco Malfoy and he uses his last second to escape to place a spell on Harry that keeps him trapped silently out of sight in the invisibility cloak. Draco confesses that the Dark Lord has tasked him with killing Dumbledore. But when he loses his nerve to complete the task, Severus Snape steps up and murders Dumbledore.
Harry pursues Snape with a vengeance and is blindsided once more by his former potions master. It is Snape who is the Half-Blood Prince.
With Dumbledore dead, Charlie Weasley maimed, and the Hogwarts security breached, it becomes clear that taking down Lord Voldemort will be no easy task. Harry is crushed when he opens the Horcrux, only to find that there is a note from a mysterious R.A.B. addressed to Voldemort, hoping that one day when he meets his match, he will be mortal once more.
Having lost so many people already, it is evident that Harry will lose more in the pursuit of the Horcruxes. Unwilling to put his friends in more danger, Harry seeks to strike out on his own, but Hermione and Ron are with him until the end, whether he wants it or not.
Want to rate movies and write movie reviews but have no idea where to start?
With the Cinephile Journal, being your own film critic has never been easier. You can log and rate all the movies you watch with an easy-to-use scoring system. The notebook has a mix of guided content and blank space, so you can write on every page and let your creativity flow. There are pages to track every movie you watch, and other pages that ask you general questions about your favorite movies, actors, and directors. This movie journal is a must-buy for every movie lover you know. Just search The Cinephile Journal on Amazon, or you can go to our show notes for a link.
Hello there, my fellow basic cinephile fan. Jeremy Hirschkorn of Jet Movement Academy here. In my experience as a gym owner and trainer, I've seen the world start to change. You'll need new strategies to keep your health in top condition. That's why I'm offering Jet Online. This is a complete training and coaching package available wherever you have internet access. Go to jetmovement.com to sign up today or contact me at jeremy@jetmovement.com. Wishing you happy listening and amazing health. Keep moving.
What'd you think of The Half-Blood Prince?
You know, it might actually surpass the fifth book as my favorite.
Okay.
Which is like really hard for me to say because I just kind of like usually pick something and then I'm like, that's it. I'm locked in. So I'm having a little bit of like a crisis of conscience right now.
You've been an Order of the Phoenix stan since day one. Like after we binged those books, and then I remember me being like, I liked it, but not as much as you. Also, I remember this random memory that just came back to me. I read The Order of the Phoenix in 2 days, and then I was dying to talk to someone about it, but you hadn't finished it yet.
Mm-hmm.
And so I actually like read a lot of it aloud to you. Do you remember that?
No.
Because I did like I had a voice for Umbridge, a like sickly sweet voice. I don't remember how I did it
now. Okay.
But I read you a lot of the book, and I remember it was because, I don't know, you were just in a place where you're like, I just don't really feel like reading. And I was like, well, that's a problem because I need to talk to you about this immediately.
Well, maybe that's part of why it has just like subconsciously been my favorite.
Yeah.
I mean, TBH, I had like massive anxiety at that time, so I like couldn't sleep a lot of nights, and you would always like hang out with me and make sure I was doing okay. So you probably utilized that time to get some Order of the Phoenix in me. I do still love Order of the Phoenix because it is the start of like more of a deep dive, more of this like background stuff, but mm-hmm. Half-Blood Prince like really steps it up with all the like memories. I just freaking love all the Pensieve moments.
The Pensieve is my favorite I don't know, like tool.
Yeah.
I guess, of any of the books. That doesn't make any sense the way I phrase that. I really like the Pensieve because I really enjoy the flashbacks, and so I love how they're able to use that to give us like so much information from the past. Mm-hmm. And I find all of the flashback scenes to be my favorite. I think they're more interesting than even what's happening in the present.
Well, I mean, I'm also like a history fan in general, as are you. I mean, you were a history teacher for a period of time. And so like, I just really love the like cause and effect where you like, you see, yeah, like James being a total jerk to Snape and you're like, okay, so it kind of tracks why this would happen. Or like seeing young Voldemort in this book, you get to see a lot of young Tom Riddle, and it's like all these different like red flags or these moments where you're like, okay, I'm kind of endeared to you. Like, I feel bad for you. I see how all these teachers and stuff were just like loving on you because you're so smart and you are an orphan and they want you to do well, and then you just like totally abuse that and become a
awful
person.
But it makes sense how we both ended up obsessed with true crime podcast.
Mm-hmm.
And like some of my favorite ones are ones that really focus on like the psychology behind why they think, usually with serial killers, like why did they do what they did, and you know, is a monster born or is it created, nature versus nurture? Obviously, mm-hmm. every serial killer is totally different, but we both noticed that a lot with Tom Riddle and his character. We noticed
so
a lot of
red flags.
Red flags of like, of course this guy grows up to be an absolute sociopath because he was a sociopathic child.
Yeah.
So some of those red flags that we noticed, we get the flashback scene where Dumbledore first meets Tom Riddle, and he goes to the orphanage. And he meets Tom. And before you even meet Tom, like, you meet the woman who's in charge of the orphanage, and she, like, has a weird feeling about Tom. And she's basically, like, so excited to get him out of there. And Dumbledore wants more information. And when he starts pressing her, she's basically like, wait a minute. Let's just establish this first. He's definitely going to your school.
You're still taking him no matter what, right? Like, yeah. I can say whatever I want, and you're, like, locked in on this.
Dumbledore's like, yes. So she begins to open up about how, like, they had taken a trip to the seaside, and, like, two of these kids kind of disappeared for a while with Tom, and then they came back, and, like, those two kids have never been the same. They basically were traumatized, but they wouldn't speak about what had happened. And then Tom is Tom, so he's always been very secretive, very aloof, didn't keep a close circle of people around him, which is a red flag. And how he was just like weird things happened around him, and kids never wanted to talk about it.
Yeah, and so he, like, clearly has control, like, socially over people and makes them feel uncomfortable, gets that, like, even if he didn't tell them to be silent or anything about it, it kind of makes you feel crazy, like, you're, like, he's, like, totally gaslighting them of, like, oh, yes. Is this a red flag? Is it not? Like, oh, it's totally me.
And they never have, like, the concrete evidence of, like, you know, we saw this and this and this. It's just this, like, they were gone. And then the kids were weird afterwards. Mm-hmm. And there's enough of those, like, little instances that just kind of make your spidey senses tingle.
But, yeah, like, we have cruelty to animals right off the bat. You know, like, he made the bunny hang himself.
And not just even cruelty, but, like, in very, what am I trying to say?
Grotesque and, like, very, like, performative ways.
Yes.
He is not someone, like, he doesn't necessarily, like, want the credit, but, like, also he needs to have, like, everyone see this.
This seems like a mafia tactic or, like, a cartel tactic where it's, like, they'll kill your brother, but then they, like, put his decapitated head on your doorstep to be, like, don't mess with us. This is, like, okay, this kid made Tom Riddle mad, and so he kills the kid's bunny, and he hangs it for this kid to find it. He's sending messages with his acts of cruelty.
Yeah, he's got that, and then he has that box full of just, like, little treasures that he's taken from other kids that he has totally, like, taken advantage of, which is totally serial killery of, like, you kept that, like, one charm bracelet. You kept that one little thing from someone, so then you can, like, relive that moment.
Yes, most serial killers kind of keep some type of a collectible of their crimes.
Yeah.
And Tom is already doing that before he's even at Hogwarts. So before the age of 11, he's already keeping mementos.
And he doesn't have any close friends. He has people that, like, will go with him places. Like, when he's in school, he doesn't have any friends, but he has that group of people who, like, follow him and idolize him, which is totally a serial killer-y type thing of not having anyone too close. But also, like, it's kind of that camouflage of, well, he has friends. He has people around him. We're not, like, so concerned about this person that we're, like, really keeping an eye on them. Like, they're doing all the quote unquote right things.
Yes. And his personality, when he turns the charm on, like, he's a very magnetic person. He's able to charm his professors. He's able to charm his classmates. He's very good looking. And so this is a kid where if he wanted to have friends, he could definitely have friends. You see someone like Snape, who definitely had a harder time connecting with people. And had a harder time being accepted because he didn't have the right look and he wasn't naturally cool. But, like, Tom Riddle just kind of had that swagger, you know, where it's like he could just be popular just because of who he was. But he never wanted that connection. He still never felt like he fit in on the inside. Yeah. But, yeah, it's kind of a dangerous combination of, like, a guy with a serious chip on his shoulder and a broken heart that he doesn't know how to communicate. And then all of this power, like he's got a natural ability with magic. Dumbledore in that scene says, you know, that he was surprised by all of the magic that Tom had already performed. Because, you know, with Harry, when Harry finds out he's a wizard, they go back and they explain those like few moments of like weird things happening where he's at the zoo with Dudley and Dudley's making fun of him and the glass disappears and like mm-hmm. the boa constrictor comes out, or like just like
that moments. His hair keeps growing yes. back whenever, you know, he ends up on top of the school when Dudley's friends are yes. chasing him
in like moments of anger, but he has no control over it. They're in these really strong emotional moments, and it's like Tom Riddle has already, like, instead of just having those emotional outbursts of like random magic things happening, like he's already figured out like, hey, I kind of have this power, and he's already kind of learning how to utilize it, even though he's never heard of magic and he doesn't mm-hmm. know the wizards are real.
Well, and his are not necessarily for like self-preservation. His mm-hmm. are for the exploitation of others.
Yeah.
And so that's a big difference between Harry and Tom. And Harry is not willing to accept that he is magic. He's like, this doesn't make sense. And Tom is just so ready to be like, oh yeah, I am special. I knew I was special. I knew I was different. And like, I wanted to be different. Yes. Harry's never wanted to be different. It's like, can I please just blend in? Can I mm-hmm. just be part of the like background here? And Voldemort's like, no, I want to be something special, something bigger than anyone else.
Mm-hmm.
And
he's got that Slytherin ambition inside of him, which makes sense because we find out that he is the last blood descendant of Salazar Slytherin. Mm-hmm. So that goes back to another Pensieve moment that is possibly my favorite series of memories from the book.
Yeah.
So we find out about the House of Gaunt, and they are basically this like inbred family of wizards, and you've got Marvolo, who is the father, and then you've got, what are their names again?
You've got Morfin, who is the son,
mm-hmm.
and you have
Merope,
which the is daughter. Tom's mother.
Yes. And Marvolo is a monster. He is abusive to his children, both physically and emotionally and verbally. And his daughter is basically there to just be his servant. They live in squalor. You know, they used to have all this family wealth, but it's like it's been squandered. Spent
throughout the generations. Yeah, like, so they've never had that wealth.
All they have is this home, and it's disgusting. And
a couple little treasures of their family, so then they can like again lean on that, like, I am better than everyone else.
They have so much arrogance, even though like they're described as being dirty, like not even dirty, filthy, and
there's like a stench coming from them from like miles away, and
the house is dirty, their the hair house is falling dirty.
Apart, like you can see the rafters through the roof, mm-hmm. you know, like it's just like straight up like a condemned house that just somehow a couple of people live in. And then you have the moment of the OG Tom Riddle,
yeah,
Tom's dad, just driving past, and he's like so handsome, and he and his family own so much of this land. They don't own the Gaunt land, but they do own like the rest of that town, and they're just like loaded. And so of course Merope's gonna look at that and be like, I want to be part of that world. It's like this aerial moment, like,
yes,
I will give up my magic. Yeah,
yes.
And so,
and he's very good looking, and her family is not very good looking because they want to preserve that Gaunt family bloodline, and so they've just been marrying their cousins and inbreeding for generation and generation. So they're described as like their eyes are looking in different directions, and like they are not cute, and they don't have the social skills. They're all parcel tongues.
So Morfin, like, straight up, they don't ever say that he speaks like English. So
that's true. They don't establish.
So I don't
that.
Even know that Morfin clearly does, because he's speaking to the Ministry of Magic person who comes to visit them.
Marvolo.
You said Morfin. Sorry, yes. Marvolo. Marvolo speaks English and parcel tongue, mm-hmm. but Morfin like never talks. Other
Yeah, he only speaks to the... Oh, no.
I guess to Dumbledore when he gets the memory.
Yes.
But still, like, he's largely still speaking in a language that, like, nobody else speaks.
Mm-hmm.
So you're, like, literally not communicating in the same way. Your brain's just wired in a different way than most other people.
Yeah, because it sounds like they didn't even really go to school or anything. It was like they were just so protective of and so proud of their family lineage that they didn't want to be contaminated by being around muggles or being around half-bloods.
Well, that makes sense because Slytherin, like, straight up leaves Hogwarts. You know? Like, so I'm assuming that all of his descendants are like... We don't need that.
That's true. They kind of leave Hogwarts on bad terms, even though he's one of the founders and a very important part of the school and its legacy.
Yeah, you're not going to go to another school after that.
No.
But, like, yeah. So you're very much...
Yeah, they left because he didn't want to accept muggle-born students or half-blood students, which is so messed up. But then we've got Merope. She sees Tom Riddle and, like, she's got a crush on him because he's cute. And he goes past her window and, like, it sounds like she's not really allowed to go out and do much. Like, her dad is very controlling of this family. And so this is someone that she's just noticed, like, hey, he's cute. I like him. So she makes a love potion and basically tricks him into...
running away. They run away to London and they're married for several years, and then the conjecture comes that she probably stopped giving him the love potion thinking that, like, we have a relationship already,
and you know? She's pregnant at that point.
Yeah, I want you to be excited about this genuinely with me. And Tom's not.
Yeah, he comes out of the love potion and he's like, what the heck, how this woman is not attractive, she's very weird. And I want to go back to the village where I'm basically a celebrity.
Yeah. Well, and he, like, had a girlfriend and stuff. So it's like, I'm not going to live in, like, a squalor with you in this situation. And I don't like you. Like, we're not friends. So.
Yeah, I'm not into this.
Yeah.
So then Merope is living in London and she's having a rough go of it. Like, she doesn't really have any money. She's pregnant. She is single. She's, aside from the time that she lived in London with Tom under the love potion, like, she's never lived anywhere else outside of her home, basically. Mm-hmm. So she's not going to have the social skills. And it sounds like Dumbledore thinks that she probably stopped using magic just because she was, like, so sad and depressed.
Yeah. And I can see why that would happen. You know, like, you've tried basically everything your entire life. You've been, like, abused as a child and like, they always made fun of her for, like, not being good at magic and stuff, which is kind of like how Neville's really bad at potions, and then he, like, does it in a different situation, and it's like, oh, if I'm not around Snape, I'm not so bad at this. So that's how it kind of sounds like when she was, like, away from the family. But yeah, she has no frame of reference for, like, how much things cost, no frame of reference for anything else. And so it's like, I'm gonna give birth to this kid and I'm gonna give that life, but I don't have it in me.
Yeah.
I don't have it in me to save myself and to be a mom and to be this for Tom, which is really very heartbreaking.
It's so sad. And you see how, like, that sadness that Tom is born into, like, his mother shows up basically in labor, finds this orphanage, they let her in, she gives birth to Tom Riddle, and she tells them that she wants to name the baby Tom after her, after the baby's father. She wants the middle name to be Marvolo after her father. The baby's last name is supposed to be Riddle. And then she dies. And Tom is born into an orphanage, and that's all the information he has. So this is a kid who's born into this extremely sad circumstance, and he has no clue who he is.
Mm-hmm.
And so
he is different.
He is different, and he's got these skills, and he's a very sad, tortured little boy who chooses evil immediately. That's just kind of inside of him.
Yeah, he leans into the darkness, and I think that you see that when he meets Dumbledore, that he has this moment to change his ways. Of, like, yes. I'm going to give these items back to these kids. I can accept that I'm different and now become a part of this different world and find some friends and, you know, people who want to be around me. And that's just not really what he goes for.
No, he doesn't. Yeah, he does not choose that at all. And he stays. And the red flags just continue. You see him when he goes to school. He, you know, the most important memory that we end up getting in the Pensieve is that moment with Slughorn. And Tom Riddle is like one of his favorites because, you know, Slughorn collects all the best and brightest students. And mm-hmm. Tom is
one of them.
And he thinks that Tom is going to go on to become the Minister of Magic.
In like 10 years.
And he's thinking, like, what's the greatest thing that you can become? The Minister of Magic. And Tom is thinking, what's the greatest thing I can become? Lord Voldemort, and I'm going to conquer the world.
Yeah.
So he asks, in that memory, he asks Professor Slughorn about what is a Horcrux. And he finds out, you know, Horcrux is this very, very dark bit of magic where if you kill, that is such a horrendous act that it splits your soul. And you can basically use that kill to encapsulate part of your soul into another object, because Tom was born an orphan. So he's a kid who, from the very formative moments of his childhood, is surrounded by death because mm-hmm. his parents have died. And so he is terrified of dying. He doesn't want to die. And he sees it as this, like, deplorable weakness. Like, how dare my mother die and abandon me here? Mm-hmm. I'm never going to be weak like her. I'm never going to die. And he says he wants to split his soul into 7 pieces because 7 is a magical, powerful number. And he wants to create 7 Horcruxes.
Which is so wild that he's already thinking about 7, at least 7 murders, you know, or I guess at least 6 murders, because then one piece stays within you. But he's already thinking about that as a teenager. And you see, it's described several times, and you see this in so many, like, serial killer documentaries about how their eyes change colors.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like this moment where you see these flashes of him being truly who he is, which is like, I am asking about these Horcruxes and I'm going to get this answer, and there is nothing else that I care about in this world right now. And then if somebody gets a little bit weirded out by it and they read that situation, they can kind of like recoil and be like, it's just for school, or like, yeah, I was just curious. And in reality, it's like you see that switch, that light mm-hmm. switch in them of like, this is what is the driving force in me.
Yeah.
So Dumbledore has a moment when Tom Riddle comes back to interview for the Defense Against the Dark Arts teacher. You see it in Hokie's memory, Hokie the house elf, mm-hmm. when he goes and visits Hepzibah Smith, I believe. I might have gotten the first name
wrong. I don't remember her name, but she's the woman who...
Who is a collector.
Yes, and she's got all of these, like, old magical artifacts. And so she's got a strong relationship with the shop owner at Borgin and Burke because she has bought a lot of their valuable collectibles. And she also has, I think she's sold some things to them as mm-hmm. well.
But there are a couple pieces that are just part of her family.
Mm-hmm.
And he gets that glint in his eye when he hears about Helga Hufflepuff's cup. And more importantly, the locket that was Merope's, that the Borgin and Burke, they bought it off of her for like 10 galleons or something like that. It was something crazy low, and they sold it for way more. And you know that she was so poor, and Tom knows these things at this point, that his mom was destitute at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And then my employer here is just like totally taking advantage of this. Like, I'd be so angry.
He's so upset, and he's also, I mean, rightfully pissed, because that locket should be his. And so when he sees it, you know that he kills that woman who and takes the locket and the cup. But you know that he doesn't feel bad about it because he sees it as like rightfully taking what is his.
Yeah. And I think it's super interesting to see that he doesn't go to a super prestigious job afterwards because that's not what gives him value. He instead goes to a place that values artifacts, that is darker, and that allows him access to all these different people's homes. Yeah. And so he is able to like scope out so many situations. He's able to see all these artifacts and find the cup and the locket and who knows what else he's seen throughout that time. But he gets, he's able to gain trust. He's able to enter someone's home multiple times to where it gives him this like alibi of like, well, it couldn't have been him. He's been here so many times.
Yeah. Why didn't he take it before?
Yeah. There would be no reason.
Someone else. Yeah.
And so it's very smart, very conniving.
He's playing the long game. You see that his overall goal, again, is not to be the Minister of Magic. It's to take over the world and to be the number one dark wizard
ever
in the universe ever of all time, greatest ever. And so step one for him of accomplishing that is he needs to make himself invincible. So he needs to set out and make these Horcruxes as quickly as possible. So him taking that job at Borgin and Burke and building up his collection of Horcruxes, that makes sense, is a logical first step. Also at Borgin and Burke's, they have a lot of dark magical artifacts and things that can be used strategically for him to commit evil acts and build up his army of Death Eaters.
Yeah, it's going to draw a certain clientele there that is going to be already a little bit more susceptible to the dark arts and interested in that pure blood lineage and feeling very, I guess, persecuted by the Ministry of Magic.
Yes.
There are people that feel that they are entitled to more than what they have been given. And I think that's a very dangerous thing that can be weaponized quite easily.
Absolutely.
You know, with the right leadership. And Voldemort takes full advantage of that.
It's and a very strategic move for him to take that job after Hogwarts.
Yeah. So I think it's really interesting to see all those, all of the memories to understand more of how Voldemort works. Essentially, like, Harry's kind of watching a true crime doc, like, in front of him and being like, okay, so now we got all these things. We know who the person is. We know what they're about. I just need to, like, figure out what their next move is.
Yeah. And we don't even know exactly how many people he's killed. We know for sure that he killed, he killed Morfinn?
Yeah, he killed Morfinn.
He killed Morfinn and he took the ring. We know that he killed the woman who,
Hepzibah Smith.
Hepzibah Smith. And that's before he ever makes a Horcrux. So he's already murdered and now he's like, oh, I want to commit six murders.
Yeah.
In that scene, Slughorn is like, oh my God, Tom, how can you even say that? You know, committing murder one time is awful.
He didn't kill Morfinn. He goes, he kills his dad and the rest of the Riddle family. And then he comes back and he plants the memory in Morfinn's mind and takes the ring.
Thank you. That's what it is. My bad.
More conniving than even just murdering his uncle. It's like, no, I'm going to murder my muggle dad. And then I'm just going to let you take the fall for it.
Yep. He's murdering at that point almost like out of revenge. And then he starts to murder after that, like for personal gain and for his Horcruxes. And then after that, he continues to murder for personal gain. He also murders for sport. This is someone who just enjoys it.
Yeah. I mean, he loves to torture people to the point of insanity. And it is just like really purely evil, which is really hard to understand, especially for someone like Harry, who definitely has seen so much evil, but like, that's not his heart.
No.
And so he would really have to have a lot of motive to kill, which I think is very important to then build up to the next book where he ends up, you know, facing off with Voldemort. He's got to have reasons. He's got to have all this backstory behind it because it's not in his character to just do something for the sake of doing it. I have to have a driving force that makes me not able to let this pass by, not just be like, you can go to Azkaban, like he does, you know, Peter Pettigrew. It's like, let's not kill him. Let's give a chance for redemption. Let's give this person another chance. Not Voldemort, though.
Voldemort, you have to actually go for the kill.
Mm-hmm. And so I think that that is crazy interesting and is just, like, really, I don't know, like, it, in a weird way, like, it's very exciting to get to the next book. You're like, oh my gosh, so much is happening.
Oh, I cannot wait, because the next book, The Deathly Hallows, is the one I feel like I don't fully remember everything that happens. So I'm excited to see.
Yeah, well, it's the one, I don't know if it's the one I've reread the least amount of times, but, like, I don't think I've read it as often as other ones, and it was, like, the newest one, so I was like, okay, it's finished.
Yeah.
You know?
I don't think I've ever reread it. I think, whoa, I finished the series, and I think I've only reread, honestly, before going through, and obviously for the podcast, rereading all of them, I know I'd reread, like, the first three or four, but I don't know if I ever got past that in my rereads.
I found that I've reread them all quite a few times, but I've kind of gotten lazy to the point where I'm just like, if I'm going to go outside to, like, a picnic or on a plane ride, I'll just, like, grab one of the books and mm-hmm. I just, like, I don't even start from the beginning. I just, like, flip to a chapter and I'm like, all right,
you know what's gonna happen.
Okay, let's just get into it. And so it's really weird, especially for the Order of the Phoenix, because I've read that one so many times that it would just be like, yeah, I started, you know, chapter 15.
Oh my
gosh.
You're
like, oh, okay, yeah, like, it just doesn't even matter at this point because I've just done it so many times. So this has actually, like, been really good for me to, like,
to force you to start at the beginning, to go through the whole thing in chronological order. That's how I feel about the movies, is that I've watched all of the movies lots of times, especially the later ones, because I like the later movies more. But I always put them on, like, when I'm going to clean the house or when I'm painting my nails or something where I need something in the background that I already know what's going to happen. And so when I sit down and I put my phone on silent and I actually stare at the screen and watch the whole movie, I notice things where I'm like, oh, I forgot about this scene.
Yeah.
Even though I've seen this movie like 20 times.
Yeah.
But apparently I'm always looking away at that scene. So, yeah.
Well, I mean, paying you're attention. Not necessarily the most observant person in the world.
I am not.
Like, there have been so many times we're just, like, driving somewhere and she's like, oh, that's new. And I'm like, no, that, you know, whether it's like a sign or something like that. And she's like, I've never seen this before. We've lived here for 10 years and driven this way hundreds of thousands of times. You just never noticed it? Nope.
Nope. Yep. No clue.
So notices things is not Ziana's forte.
Not my strong suit. But I do notice. It's about time to take a break and hear from our sponsors for this episode. Okay, Basic Cinephiles, we are so excited to tell you about one of our favorite podcasts, which is Girl Crush Podcast. It is hosted by best friends Allie and Anne, and you know that we love a podcast that is hosted by female best friends because, in case you haven't noticed, Adelia and I are totally best friends.
Definitely. I mean, we happen to be related, but that's, like, neither here nor there.
We just got lucky genetically. So Girl Crush Podcast celebrates women in film by ranking every movie in an actress's filmography. This season, which is season 3, is Reese Witherspoon.
And do we ever love Reese Witherspoon?
We're obsessed.
Yeah, I mean, Legally Blonde is one of our favorite movies ever.
If you were here for the OG early days of The Basic Cinephile, you will remember that my profile pic, or whatever you call it on Instagram, was literally Elle Woods.
Yeah.
So we are obsessed with Reese Witherspoon. So they're going through, they are watching all of Reese Witherspoon's movies. They've created their own ranking system. So they're going to rank all the movies. And then at the end of the season, they'll have a list of, like, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, et cetera, of all of her movies ranked in order from best to worst. And it's going to be super fun. So be sure to check out Girl Crush Podcast. You can find them on Instagram at girlcrush_pod, or you can check out their website, which is www.girlcrushpodcast.com. And be sure to listen to this season wherever you get podcasts. Speaking of girl crushes, we've got some girl crushes from this book / all of the Harry Potter books thus far.
Okay. Jenny Weasley came to play the last two books, but especially this one.
I really, honestly, one of my biggest takeaways so far in rereading the series is how I undervalued and just straight up, like, didn't notice Ginny Weasley. She plays a very central role in the series.
She really does. And I mean, I think that that's kind of like the whole point of it is that like Harry doesn't really realize how important Ginny is. And then all of a sudden it's like, now I can't stop thinking about her. And so she's just like kind of around more. And, you know, she's not the little sister anymore. I mean, she's only a year younger than them, which feels so big at 11 years old.
It does, but also it doesn't. Like, you and I are 2.5 years apart, but we were 2 grades apart in school, so we always just say 2 years apart. And, I mean, we were always friends, but the years that we did go to school together, it's true. Like, we always had different school friends, and we always had different classes because we were in different grades. It wasn't until, like, I think high school choir was the only classes we ever had together.
Yeah. So I feel like up until this point, they've been very separated, and I think that they wanted to. Like, Ron wanted to finally have his own group of friends, and Ginny is ready to have her own group of friends. And also, Ginny was, like, super into Harry and couldn't talk to him.
So shy. And, I mean, you feel that. I definitely had those crushes in school where it was, like, they came around and I became straight up mute.
Big time. And had I somehow let a giant beast into the school and, you know, had to be rescued by my crush and, you know, like, I would be so mortified. And then, you know, like, that's my brother's best friend. And he, like, comes and stays with us during holidays. Like, he's caught me, like, running down the stairs in my pajamas to, like, go get breakfast. You know, like, those are weird moments.
That is very true. And also, it's not just any of your brother's friends. It's Ron's friend. And aside from Percy, I think Ron is kind of her dorkiest brother.
Yeah.
So it's like, you're going to see Ron and you're just like, oh my God, like, what does Harry even know about me? Or like, you know?
Yeah. What has Ron said?
You cannot trust Runel Waslip.
No, you really cannot. And like Fred and George, they're a little bit older. So they're like, there wouldn't be as much overlap for everyone else. But with Ron, you're like, we're kind of lumped in together. But then like, again, Ron has one of the biggest cases of foot and mouth disease ever. The boy does not know what he's saying.
No.
And does not think through things in the way that most other people do.
Not at all. But Ginny and Hermione are always super close. And I love that that's all a part of the series. Even though Ginny doesn't necessarily get as much airtime in the books, but in the earlier books. But you do hear, like, that clearly her and Hermione, like, hang out.
They spend the holidays together. Like, when Ginny joins the Gryffindor team as Seeker in the fifth book, all the brothers are just, like, completely baffled that Ginny even knows how to fly. And Hermione's just like, yeah, she uses all of your brooms. She rotates through everybody's brooms and, yeah, she goes and practices. And they're like, what? I didn't. Because they're all oblivious. They never saw their little sister go out to the shed, take their broom, and go fly somewhere. They're just in their own world. She just doesn't even register as someone who would be sneaky, which is why she's so sneaky and wonderful.
Oh, yeah. She's one of the sneakiest. There's a point in the Order of the Phoenix where they're trying to listen in on a meeting that's happening that they're not supposed to. And so they're trying to do one of those, like, extendable ears down there to listen. And Ginny's like, oh, yeah, no, you can't listen through that door. And they're all like, what are you talking about? And she's like, yeah, it's got this certain jinx or, like, spell cast on it. And I think it was Tonks that taught her, like, if you throw something at it and it kind of, like, explodes
bounces back
or something, then that's how you can tell that this spell has been cast on that door. And so Ginny had been throwing, I think it was, like, dung bombs at it. And so they were all, like, they'd exploded. And so they're all like, Fred and George at this point are going into their 7th year. They should be the smartest. And Ginny is the youngest in the group. And she's the one that's like, oh yeah, no. So I already know exactly what curse has been placed on this door. I already know that you can't listen. I've already checked.
And then she just like blames it on Crookshanks. And yes. So she like completely gets away with it. And
Mrs. Weasley comes down and she's like, what is this? Is a mess. And Ginny just immediately lies and says it was Crookshanks. And then she's like, oh, of course, you know, because it's Ginny. Why would you not believe Ginny? And then a couple minutes later, she looks at Ginny's hands and she's like, oh, you need to go wash your hands. Like, you're filthy.
Just not even putting it together. It's because you were throwing dung bombs.
And that's kind of her whole family, like, never quite puts two and two together because she gets away with stuff, but she does it in a smart way, which is not what Ron tries to do. And she does it in like a quiet way, which is not what the twins try to do.
No, not at all.
So she can kind of fly under that radar, let the boys get in trouble for things. She can look like a sweet little angel, but low key, like, she's the trickiest Weasley of them all.
Yeah, and I love the friendship between Hermione and Ginny in finding out that, like, Ginny's always had the crush on Harry. It never went away. But Hermione just kind of came up and was like, hey, why don't you just, like, take time, like, go date other people, go figure out what you want, and just, like, take the pressure off of yourself when you're around Harry and just be yourself. You're so much fun. We love hanging out with you. You're all in your head. And so she does. And she's like, okay, I mean, if it's not going to be Harry, I might as well have some fun right now. I might as well date Dean. I might as well date Michael Corner. Like, you know what? Fine. I am desirable. And
she is. She ends up being very popular, dating lots of people.
It's because she's funny. She's smart. She's adventurous. And she says what's on her mind.
Yes.
Which, I mean, we can all say this very confidently. I love Harry. And he is very smart in very many ways. And he just does not pick up on it with girls.
No, not at all.
Doesn't pick up on it with Cho. Like, he just is so, like, so blinders on. Just, like, doesn't get it. Like, somebody, Cho straight up, like, asks him to go to the Valentine's Day, like, dinner thing at Madame Puttyfoot's. And he, like, it takes him a minute to be like, oh, yeah, no, I will take you. I didn't realize that you wanted to go. Well, why would I ask you?
Yeah.
Why did I bring this up?
A really good example of that is at the end of The Half-Blood Prince, Bill Weasley has been maimed by Fenrir Greyback, the werewolf, who is not hot, for the record. And he's laying in the hospital wing, and you've got, like, all of the Weasleys around him and, like, attending to him. And then Fleur comes in, and, you know, Fleur and Mrs. Weasley do not see eye to eye. They just, like, they're so different. They both annoy each other. And they have this moment when Mrs. Weasley is like, oh my God, it's just so sad. My son had been so handsome and he was going to be married. And Fleur just goes, what do you mean he was going to be married? And Mrs. Weasley's like, oh, well, you know, and she feels that Ron moment of like, oh, I really stepped in it this time. And Fleur's like, oh my God, do you think that he won't want to marry me because he's, you know, they don't think he's going to be a full werewolf, but they do think that he's going to have like some wolf tendencies. And so she's like, oh my God, like, do you think he's not going to want to marry me anymore? And Mrs. Weasley kind of looks at her and she's like, no, I thought maybe you wouldn't want to marry a werewolf, which is, you know, understandable.
And he was so attractive before, and now he's like, not at all.
And Fleur just goes like, well, I'm attractive enough for the both of us. And this is my husband. And Mrs. Weasley had been putting on like some ointments for his wounds. And she takes that and she goes, no, that's mine. Give it to me. Like, this is my husband. And so she starts like attending to his wounds. And Harry's describing that scene like very matter-of-factly. And then he's like, yeah, and then, I don't know, out of nowhere, they just started crying, and then they hugged, and basically it's like, I don't understand women. And it's like, reading that as a woman, and probably as anyone with, like, some emotional intelligence and, you know, a good understanding of, like,
Social interactions
and some intuition, you see that, like, well, of course they're gonna cry and hug, because they've had this moment where they really connect, like, Mrs. Weasley really gets to see this sweet side of Fleur. Like, oh my God, she really loves Bill no matter what.
Yeah.
It's not about his looks or whatever. Like, she loves my son. And because you love my son, that means I love you. And she offers her, there's like that tiara that's Auntie Muriel's. And she offers that to her. And Fleur, you know, like, they're still kind of putting up a front at that point. Fleur's like, yes, that would be great. That sounds lovely.
Yeah, no, it
and Harry's just like, well, I don't know where this interaction came from. And you're like, are you kidding me? Like, she just confessed her undying love for Bill, and Mrs. Weasley just offered her this like priceless family heirloom to wear for the wedding. Like, of course, welcome, this is a sweet family moment. But because they didn't, you know, just explicitly say those things, Harry's like, well, I don't know what just happened.
I love that. But then also you have several moments after, you know, like Harry has just come back from chasing after Snape and he's like walking up to Dumbledore's body and he's like, won't leave it. And he just like feels Ginny's like hand in his hand. And he just like goes with her. He just like knows, she just like leads him to where he needs to be. And there are a couple moments where he says, like, he looks at Ginny and he just knows that they're both feeling the same way. Like,
yeah,
I don't have to speak these things out because you just get it. And I mean, Ginny has been through so much. She has not necessarily experienced everything with Harry in the same way that Ron and Hermione have, but she has been there every step of the way for all of these like big moments. And spent a lot of time with you. So it's like, maybe I wasn't a central figure, but like, I've heard everything.
Yeah.
You know, there's no real secrets here. And I know who you are. And I know that you're gonna not want me to be in your life right now.
Yeah.
Because that's who you are. I, as Ginny, am gonna tell you right now, whatever you say doesn't really actually work for me. You know, like, sure, we're broken up for, you know, X amount of time, but like, you're still my man. And like,
yeah,
like, this is still a thing. It's just like, we'll press pause for a minute.
Yeah, because he's basically like, I can't be with you right now because Voldemort's gonna know that we're close. He uses people that are close to me as a way to get to me, and I don't want to risk you. And she basically says, because he's just like, we can't be together, and she just looks at him and is like, this is gonna be for some stupid noble reason, isn't it?
Yeah.
And laughs, because it's like, she gets it, and so she's not gonna push back against that. She's not a Lavender Brown who's like very immature about her love. Like, she's someone who, again, has been through a lot. And so she's going to understand, like, if Harry can't be with me right now, I'm not going to fight it. He's got more important things to do. I care about him and his life. I don't want him obsessing over me and what I'm thinking if that takes away from him surviving.
Yeah. You know? And I feel like Ginny, we've kind of got like that Order of the Phoenix, like, junior, you know, level. You've got like the DA, and then you've got like the DA plus, which is like, you were in the DA, but you also know about the Order of the Phoenix and all these things going on. They've got a greater goal here.
Yeah.
So it's like, as much as we have this like trauma bond and I love being with you and everything, at the end of the day, like, my brother just got maimed. My other brother is, you know, like, excommunicated from the family. We've got Ron, who is gonna be with you ride or die. We've got, you know, like, all of this stuff. My parents are in the order, you know, like, everyone that I love is doing something in actionable ways to fight Voldemort. And I understand that you are central to this whole thing and you need to do what you've got to do.
Yeah. Ginny understands what's at stake. Yeah, she has just as much to lose, if not more, than Harry. And she, more than anyone else, she understands what it's like to be possessed by Horcrux, be possessed by Lord Voldemort, you know, in Chamber of Secrets. Like,
she almost dies.
She had all of these like moments where she'd wake up like covered in blood and she's like, I don't know what,
how terrifying
happened. Yeah, she's 12 years old. No, she would have been 11. She's 11 years old at that point. That is a lot to go through in a year. And so she's going to understand, like, Harry is up against a very deep and powerful magic. And, like, she's not messing around with that.
No, she's not. And she's so great. She's so great.
Ginny is my girl crush.
Yeah, Ginny would be my girl crush, definitely, for this book. I mean, we've got McGonagall, who's like the OG girl crush. She's like the best.
Dumbledore dies, and this woman, within 15 minutes, is already, she's acting headmaster.
Yeah.
She's in the office. She's making decisions. She's running the place. Like, Minerva McGonagall is a solid second in command.
Yeah, she, like, calls all the teachers to come meet with her. She knows that Rufus Scrimgeour is on his way. She's been talking to Harry like an adult. And you know what? That's the thing about McGonagall. She never really treats them like children necessarily. She puts you in your place, but she will do that to any single person who comes her way. She's very fair. And when she realizes that Scrimgeour's on his way, and Harry's like, I leave right now.
Get out of here. Yeah.
You don't need to do that. Absolutely not. That's not, this isn't your business. If you don't want to go over this a million times, get out of here. Yeah. These are people who want to use you. I want to get information from you, but I don't want to use you. These other people, they want to use you.
Yeah. She's clearly annoyed because she asks Harry, you know, basically, like, what were you and Dumbledore up to tonight? And he says, like, I can't tell you because Dumbledore didn't want me to. And McGonagall is like, dude, the rules have changed. Like, Dumbledore was alive when he told you that. Now he's dead. Like, you need to confide in me so I can help you. And Harry goes, no, I wasn't supposed to. And I've got this. And McGonagall's clearly kind of annoyed because she would like to have the information and she would like to help. But also, she treats Harry like an adult. She treats him with respect. And it's like, I may not like the decision that you're making right now, but I do respect you.
Well, because she's going to make a direct question to you. She's going to present her information.
Yeah.
And if your statement is no, then I'm going to wait until you say yes on something. You've given me a definitive answer, and I'm going to respect that.
Yep.
So if you're not going to give it to me, one, I'm not going to waste my time trying to convince you to, you know, be a team player and let me know.
Yeah.
And two, I'm going to trust Dumbledore.
Yep.
If he told you not to tell anyone and he told you to do X, Y, and Z, follow through with it. Do it.
And she understands. She's like, I've got enough on my plate already at this moment. Yes, I would like to know what you were up to so that I can help, but I fully understand. I've already got more than enough on my own end. And so she not only treats Harry like an adult, but it's also, she treats the other students who stepped up and fought like adults. So at that end scene when Malfoy has smuggled in the Death Eaters, it's not just Order of the Phoenix adults that fight back. It's Harry when he gets back, obviously. And then it's Ron, Hermione, Luna, Ginny, Neville. And they straight up fought Death Eaters for the second year in a row. First time for Ginny, but because she didn't break into the Ministry of Magic. Did she?
I think so. Yeah. Yeah.
Oops. My bad. I might be messing this up. Anyways, it's their second time fighting the Death Eaters, and McGonagall sees that and she acknowledges that. She's like, okay, these, yes, technically they're kids, whatever, but like, they've proven that they are serious about fighting against Voldemort, and they have bravely put themselves in harm's way to accomplish that, you know?
Well, I think there's a stark contrast when Harry is with Dumbledore and they're going to get the Horcrux, and Dumbledore says, for the boat, he's like, I don't think that weight matters. I think that the magical ability matters, that that's going to be the thing that, you know, either literally sink or swim. He's like, I don't think he would consider a student even smart enough. Even, you know, like, no student, no underage wizard would even be worth Voldemort's time to feel like that's an opponent, a foe. And so, you know, then they got across. Whereas Dumbledore and McGonagall and even a lot of the people in the Order of the Phoenix, I see that you're a child and I want to protect you is the thing. Like, I see that you are underage and I don't want you to be put through the situation. However, I recognize that what you bring to the table is very valuable.
Yes.
And I'm not gonna...
You have skills and you can help us. And then you also see on the other side of that with the Death Eaters, it's like Voldemort gave Malfoy this job. Like, you need to kill Dumbledore. And he's setting him up for a loss. He doesn't think that he's capable of doing it. But also, he's at this point where it's like, he's not above using kids. But he doesn't value them or respect them in the same way, which is what you see from the Order of the Phoenix. So it's like, you see, both sides are utilizing underage wizards, but it's in very different ways.
Yeah. And Malfoy is essentially given this role because his dad messed up and is, you know, in Azkaban, and it's kind of like this
payback. Yeah.
Prove yourself. Like, I set you up for a loss. But even Malfoy, he doesn't trust Crabbe or Goyle. You know, that's his, you know, Ron and Hermione, and he's never going to confide in them.
Mm-hmm.
You can be here. You can be my cronies. You can be a lookout. But no, I don't trust you, because, I mean, the Death Eaters, for the most part, are out for themselves.
Yep.
You know, so you don't have this good collective thing that you're working towards. You've got a lot of people who want glory for themselves.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's a big part of, like, Malfoy not wanting Snape's help. It's like, you want the glory. You want the glory. And you're like, no, sometimes people just want to help you.
Yeah.
But that's not a Slytherin mindset.
They don't believe in the teamwork makes the dream work.
Mm-mm.
Okay, so getting to Snape, I mean, this is the book where the Snape is, like, at his peak detestability, if that's a word.
Gosh, he's so terrible.
He's
the worst.
He's awful. He's still just, like, so mean, and then he kills Dumbledore, which obviously at the end of this, I remember reading it for the first time, and you're just like your stomach just falls into your butt at that moment. You're like, oh my God, he really is evil. But then my second thought that immediately followed it was, I knew it.
Yeah.
I knew he was bad. I knew it. I never trusted him. And I still don't trust him. We'll talk about the quote unquote redemption of Snape in the next book, but honestly, I still don't think that Snape ever redeems himself.
No. Gosh, he's so mean, he's so conniving, he is just like, it's like, it's so frustrating. And my big takeaway from this with the Half-Blood Prince is Harry is using the Half-Blood Prince's book, and he straight up says at one point that I learned more from the prince than I ever did from Snape. And so Snape has every tool in his arsenal to be a good teacher. And he just actively doesn't do that.
He just chooses to be a bully. Yeah.
It's someone like teaching you to drive a car, and they're like, well, you get in. You just drive it.
Yeah.
And you're like, well, maybe you should tell me 18 different things of, like, well, okay, you check your mirrors first, and you do that, you know.
That's actually part of teaching. You have to learn how to teach to different learning styles. Mm-hmm. And so part of it is, like, yes, it's the student's responsibility to make sure that they are paying attention, doing the work, asking questions, and trying to understand the material. But the other 50% of the responsibility is on the teacher to assess your students, to see if they're getting it, and then to realize, you know, the Nevilles Neville works hard.
Yeah.
Neville's always one of the hardest working people in the room, and he doesn't always get it. And so it's like, well, then it's on you to find a way to reach Neville. And clearly, being a turd and yelling at him and publicly ridiculing him doesn't work. So maybe we should stop trying that.
Yeah, and potions is, like, so much like cooking, and there are some people who read a recipe and they can just, like, okay, so I do this, then this, then this, then this. And that is the way their brain works. And other ones, it's like, hey, you're going to be looking for these things. You're going to smell these things. You're going to, you know, if it feels too fluffy, or, you know, like, if it feels too much this or this. And then you, like, okay, that's how you gauge it. That's how you see if this is good or not. Because Snape, as the Half-Blood Prince, is, like, expanding on these potions and stuff of, like, okay, you actually use this part of your knife to, like, squish it instead of, like, trying to chop it up.
Yeah.
That is something that you can teach your students. Hey, just because this is in the book, you want to go by what
that's
it's saying,
so
try
true.
It out. And if it's not working for you, you're going to kind of pivot. You're going to see what works for you.
He knows all these tips and tricks, and he's like, yeah, I'm not telling you.
Yeah.
God, what?
Snape. What a jerk.
Snape's the worst.
He really is, and he doesn't get any better as Defense Against the Dark Arts. And yeah, you don't trust them at all. You don't trust them at all from the very beginning, from the unbreakable vow.
Yep. You're like, ooh, this guy is on the wrong side. God, I love the Half-Blood Prince. This is still my favorite book.
It's really great. And you brought up a really good point outside of the podcast that, like, Draco was also, like, born destined to be a part of this. Like, Harry yes. is marked from the beginning, but so is Draco.
Draco is born into a family that has a mission. You know, Lucius and Narcissa, maybe they love each other, maybe they're a love match, but beyond that, they're a strategic match. They are two
their business.
They're two strong, pure blood wizarding families coming together. They have a son, and he is destined for greatness, you know? Like, Lucius wants Malfoy, or Draco, to follow in his footsteps, and he's born into a family of Death Eaters.
Mm-hmm.
And a family of Death Eaters is not just gonna, you know, when Voldemort comes back to power, they're not just gonna be like, all right, Draco, you just do what you feel is right. Make your own decisions. Carve your own path, buddy. Like, mm-hmm. not at all. They're like, no. You need to be
friends with the right people. You need to be making honor. The right grades. You need to be, yeah, it's all about those connections.
All about
looks. I mean, you see that from the very first book.
They don't care if he's happy.
No, and Draco brings that to the table for Harry of, like, you know, you don't want to get associated with the wrong people, because that's been so ingrained
in
him.
That's all he knows.
That it's like, there are right and wrong people.
Mm-hmm.
And this is how you tell. It's by their bloodline.
Yep.
And you're like, that's really messed up to put that expectation on your kid.
Yeah.
And I mean, you're born into a very biased, bigoted family.
Yeah. And this is, nothing else will be tolerated. And even though he doesn't make the decision to kill Dumbledore, so in that moment, you're like, okay, maybe Draco's not all bad, but mm-hmm. I don't get the impression that he didn't kill Dumbledore because of some crisis of conscience. I think he just freaked out.
I think that he's young.
I got scared.
I thought through all of these things. I did all the things that I was supposed to do, and I made it happen, and I've been so focused on making it happen that I haven't necessarily thought about the action that means that I then have to do.
Yeah.
And I mean, how many times it's like a kill or be killed. So I'm either going to kill Dumbledore or my whole family is going to get killed. Like, yeah. That's the deal. In which case, like, I don't blame you for going through with this.
He's got a lot at stake too. He's born into this war. He's just born onto the other side of it.
Yeah. So I do. That is a moment that I do feel bad for him, because I think that in one of the first episodes I was saying that, like, Draco is kind of like redeemable, whatever. I don't think he is. I don't think he's a good person. I think that he's lovable because Tom Felton is lovable.
Tom Felton is lovable.
He same with Alan Rickman. Like, mm-hmm. he is what made Snape more redeemable, lovable.
Totally agree.
But in the books, I just feel like Malfoy is, Draco's not, he's not a good person.
No.
But he doesn't necessarily, like, I guess he's forced to grow up faster than he should have. And so has Harry. But
so are all of these. They said, yeah. I think it was Hannah Abbott, like, gets pulled out of class because her mom's dead. Like, people are losing people in this book.
Yeah.
It's going down.
There are sisters who, their brother was attacked by Fenrir Greyback and he dies.
Yeah.
You know, like.
So at this point, it's more than just Harry who's losing people. It's more than just Neville. It's like everyone has something
to lose.
At stake to lose, and you're very aware of it. God, I love the Half-Blood Prince.
It's really good. It's really good. And I think that it's so good because of, like, the pacing of things. You go from, like, such it's, you know, so action in Goblet of Fire, and then it really slows down in Order of the Phoenix, and it's just, like, infuriating. But then that sets it up for the next book, which, you know, you see how the Ministry of Magic gets, you know, like, sucked into, like, these political wrong ways. Mm-hmm. You know, like, they don't get to just be good or bad. Like, they're just kind of like, I don't know, you know, you get Umbridge and more power, you've got, you know, mm-hmm. all these people that are Imperius Curse and whatnot, but, like, the ministry is infuriating. I mean, politics is infuriating. You're like, can't we just repave the roads? Like, this pothole's really bad. And you're like, well, we actually had to, you know, go through 40 different people to fill this one pothole. Get a real Ron Swanson moment of like, I'm just going to go fix it.
Can we just solve the problem? Yeah, they don't. And no one really knows how to solve this problem because last time when it quote unquote got solved, it was an accident.
Yeah.
There was no strategy behind that. So they are like, well, we don't know how to recreate that scenario because that was a one in a million.
Yeah.
And so we don't know what to do. I'm very excited to watch this movie. Very excited to read The Deathly Hallows. And yeah, so you guys will have to join us back here next week.
Yeah. Tell us everything that you've been thinking about for Half-Blood Prince or the whole series. What are your hot takes? We'd love to hear that. You can follow us at The Basic Cinephile on Instagram, on TikTok at The Basic Cinephile, on Twitter at The Basic Cinef 1. That's cinephile without the I-L-E and the number 1. You can find us at our website, www.thebasiccinephile.com. And you can find us wherever you listen to podcasts. Just search The Basic Cinephile.
Yep, we drop new episodes every Thursday.
Yeah.
See you next week.